Thank you for having me here. My title is How Black Holes Dine Above the Eddington Limit Without Overeating or Excessive Belching. And so just to explain that, I'm going to talk about accretion onto black holes. That's the eating reference. And really at this in this limit of above the Eddington limit, which I'll explain what that is for those of you who might not know about it. And without overeating means without trying to accrete too much mass to get out the luminosity that you need, get out the photons you need, but also not driving too much of an outflow as well. Okay? And I really want to emphasize this is work done in collaboration with Yanfei Jiang and Jim Stone. Yanfei is now a postdoc at the KITP, and he's great. People should hire him if you have jobs. I don't know why he doesn't already have a faculty job. Jim has one, so he's good. He's doing pretty well. So just a quick outline. I'm going to do an overview. Since this is, you're probably mostly theorists, although not all of you, but I'll flip it and I'll start with the theoretical motivation and then get into one of my main observational motivations. And then I'll take the second half to just talk about some of our numerical simulations and what we're learning from them. I was searching around. This is kind of a little hard to see, but I was searching around for pictures of the Eddington limit, and one of the first things I came up with was this image of Eta Carinae, it's actually an album cover from a death metal band called the Eddington Limit. So you can check them out on Facebook. They seem to have lots of astronomy references, so more than by random chance.
So Eta Carinae is at the Eddington limit.
Well, it's close. It's probably close to the Eddington limit. There's some question of whether it exceeds it during the outbursts. It's not my main focus, so I'm not sure what the latest thinking is, but it's definitely very close to it. So for those of you who might not do as much astronomy or astrophysics, or the Eddington luminosity, the Eddington limit is just a luminosity, and so it's a luminosity where the outward radiation force balances the inward gravitational force. Usually, this is derived in spherical symmetry. Actually, you don't need to assume spherical symmetry. You can do this quite generally with just using any surface, actually. But if you basically take the spherical symmetry limit, the gravitational force drops off as 1 over r squared. And at fixed luminosity, the radiation force goes as the flux. That also drops off as 1 over r squared. So when you set them equal to each other, you get a value for the luminosity where they balance, which just depends on the mass of the object and fundamental constants. It was first derived by Sir Arthur Eddington, who's probably most famous for his 1919 eclipse observations that tested general relativity. But he was one of the main theorists in astronomy at the time. Just to, again, put numbers that people might not have at the back of their mind, the Eddington luminosity for, if we assume electron scattering, which is what's relevant for black holes, as the opacity is 10 to the 38 ergs per second for something, the mass of the sun. Of course, it scales linearly with the mass, so something that's bigger has a larger Eddington luminosity associated with it. So bigger things can be more luminous before they start blowing themselves apart via radiation forces. In accretion disks, we like to talk about radiative efficiency. And so this is a quantity where we take the luminosity coming from the accretion disk. We have an accretion rate, a mass per unit time through the disk. And then we calculate the radiative efficiency just by dividing the luminosity, the energy radiated per unit time, by the sort of rest mass energy flux, m dot c squared. And what we often like to do is take these two equations, assume an efficiency, and then calculate an equivalent Eddington accretion rate to the Eddington luminosity. And so the nice typical value people take for the efficiency in black holes is about 0.1. So you roughly can get about, typically we think you can get about 10% or so of the rest mass energy out. That's a pretty small number, 2 by 10 to the minus 8 solar masses per year. So if something's only a solar mass black hole, then you don't need that much mass accreted, although it's not trivial to do that. But if you want, say, a 10 to the 8 solar mass black hole, now you're talking about accreting a solar mass or so a year to reach this Eddington limit. Okay? All right. Now, yeah, I know it's a bad joke, but we do have a lot of reasons to think that the black holes radiate above the Eddington limit. So the main one, familiar to probably some of the people here, is core collapse of massive stars and compact binary mergers almost certainly exceed the Eddington limit accretion rate. But there, the process, they exceed it by so much that photons really don't even matter. The dominant cooling radiation process is neutrino emission. So we're going to essentially ignore that topic for this for this talk.
Sorry, since you're going to ignore it, is there an equivalent of Eddington limit for neutrino cooling?
Yeah, well, it's harder to write down because the nice thing about the opacity for electron scattering is it's a constant, essentially a cross section, whereas the cross section for neutrinos, the dominant cross sections go as energy squared. Mm-hmm. So it's a little more complicated to write down a limit, but there is sort of the same thing. I mean, I think the assumption is that it doesn't really come into play.
It doesn't.
Yeah.
So you don't actually reach that limit, or?
Let me remember. I think you just don't reach the limit. Is the thing. You get up well? Yeah, I think you don't reach the limit. Is the answer? But I don't remember exactly. Good question. So the other case that's going to be increasingly important in astronomy is a fallback during stellar tidal disruptions. You have a star come in, gets tidally ripped apart by the black hole. The material goes off, a lot of it goes off to infinity, but some of it stays bound to the hole, falls back on, say, a year time scale. And the stuff that falls back first is actually falling back at a rate that's above the Eddington limit. In fact, I think they're doing a party there's a big tidal disruption conference going on right now to celebrate Martin Rees's birthday. The other case is mass transfer in X-ray binaries. That's the case where you have a companion star. It's in a binary system with a black hole, and it's close enough that the star fills its Roche lobe or maybe be a wind, and the material gets captured by the black hole and accretes. So at least for some stages of people model this, it's sort of theoretical, but we think that the mass transfer that you can achieve, at least for relatively brief periods of time compared to the age of the systems, can exceed the Eddington rate by quite a bit, actually. So we think you should be able to get super Eddington accretion here. And then finally, galaxies. Some galaxies have a ton of mass sitting around in their centers. They have supermassive black holes. And so we think they can funnel material at more than the solar mass per year rate that I said would be needed in some cases. So we think that all of these systems probably have super Eddington stages at some point or another. There is some observational evidence to support this. One that I'll talk about more in a few slides is the existence of what are called ultraluminous X-ray sources. So these are sources that if they're 10 solar mass black holes, they're almost certainly, and the luminosities would imply that they're above their Eddington limits. We can observe the luminosities of quasars, and there are methods for estimating their masses. They have these broad emission lines in quasars. And if you measure the widths of the emission lines, you can assume that has something to do with gravity and get masses. There's some uncertainties in that. But if you take those masses at face value, I don't always take them at face value. But if you do, you infer that some of these sources are super Eddington. And then we see quasars at high redshift that have masses of a billion solar masses. Again, if you trust these mass estimation methods. And it's hard to imagine that they get to such large masses without some stages of super Eddington accretion, although there might be ways to get around that. And then my favorite, which is shown here, is you can look at the X-ray binary luminosity function. So these X-ray binaries are these sorts of sources. Here, where you have accretion from a companion, this is actually mostly high mass X-ray binaries. But anyway, you look at this X-ray binary mass function in local galaxies, and it's a power law. Okay, this is basically luminosity per number times luminosity per luminosity bin. It's a nice power law. And you would not expect this if the Eddington limit was an actual limit, right? There's an Eddington, most of these are probably accretion onto neutron stars, and the Eddington limit would be right there. See a nice power law through there, not a sharp cutoff. And for 10 solar masses, it would be up here. And there's no statistically strong evidence of a cutoff here either. So it seems like these sources, particularly neutron stars, find a way to accrete above their Eddington limit. And most famously, at least recently, there was an ultraluminous X-ray source, something that people thought might be a 10 solar mass black hole accreting at 10 times Eddington. It showed pulsations, proving that it was a neutron star that was accreting at least 10 times the Eddington luminosity, maybe as much as 100 times its Eddington above its Eddington limit. So neutron stars definitely know how to violate this limit. Yeah?
But this is for like short period of time?
Well, we don't know. I mean, it's certainly for on observationally timescales, it's been above the luminosity. So in that sense, yeah. I mean, compared to dynamical times, yes, very long. Yeah, for sure. So that's a big puzzle that a lot of people are trying to figure out. I mean, neutron stars have strong magnetic fields, so most of the ideas for that case is that in some way or another, the magnetic fields are so strong that they're basically containing the plasma that would otherwise be accelerated by radiation pressure. Now, black holes, we don't think, can do that, so it's a different, potentially a different problem. All right, so that's kind of the sort of motivation and the observational evidence. I want to go into the sort of theory, and so you're going to see that when I discuss the theory, it's mostly cartoons. And that's somewhat intentional. So like anything in accretion, basically it was all worked out by Shakur Sunyaev in 1973 in the very first paper. Pretty much everything that's been done since is kind of redundant afterwards. But so what they did was they realized that, so they took their model, and I didn't explain this in detail, but what Shakur and Sunyaev did was they worked out what an accretion disk would look like if the disk was really thin. So they basically had a scale height, a vertical scale height in their accretion disk. And then they basically derived they solved the fluid equations under the assumption that the scale height, h, was much, much less than the radius everywhere. And that sort of separates the equations in a way that makes it easier to solve. But then they take their model and they can compute what h is, and h depends on the accretion rate. And so when the accretion rate gets to this value, this Eddington value I said, h becomes of order r in the inner part of the disk. And so the inner part of the disk is no longer this thin assumption that they made to begin with. And so now the model breaks down at that point, but what they saw that it was breaking down, and they thought, okay, what happens in this case? And so they basically argued that when h becomes of order r, the main effect is that because this inner flow becomes quasi-spherical, probably and you're exceeding the Eddington limit, basically you're going to have radiation pressure from the photons. These yellow arrows are supposed to represent photons coming out, and they're going to be driving outflows. Okay? And they thought this is probably going to be a very non-steady state process with lots of outflow. They did point out that another thing that might happen, although they didn't think it would be as important, was that advection, photons might be carried into the flow, because the diffusion time for photons to go out in the vertical direction, because this is basically they're diffusing out because the optical depths in these flows are quite large, so they scatter many, many times before they get out, that time scale is too long compared to the inflow time scale. And so most of the energy might get advected into the black hole. Shakur and Sunyaev didn't think that was going to be as important, but then lots of other researchers, particularly Polish researchers and various Japanese groups, spent a lot of time looking at models where the predominant mechanism was advection rather than outflow. Okay, and so what the basic result of all of these theories is kind of they all kind of came to the same conclusion, more or less, but with two different mechanisms at play. Okay, and so they said that these things are not in general going to radiate much above the Eddington luminosity. They might accrete a lot higher than the Eddington luminosity. The material might come in through the disk, but for various reasons, the photon luminosity is not going to exceed the Eddington luminosity very much. And so what they argued was this, or the argument was for two different reasons. One is this idea that the inner disk becomes spherical and it's going to drive outflows as soon as it becomes spherical. Those outflows, the radiation that's pushing on that outflow, that will turn the photon energy into outflow kinetic energy, rather, and so we won't actually observe those photons. Okay? We won't observe that photon energy. And then this advection argument I made, the advection time becomes longer than the diffusion time, and so rather than the photons diffusing out and getting to observers, they're going to get trapped in the black hole. And so there's a radius associated with the spherization of the flow, and there's a trapping radius, which is the radius inward of which all this material gets advected in. And to within order unity, they're basically the same radius, and it kind of depends on the model details. And they basically scale with the gravitational radius times the accretion rate over Eddington. So as the accretion rate gets well above the Eddington limit, this radius moves out. If you try to compute what the luminosity would be in a simple model of this, what you find is that the luminosity basically is of order of the Eddington luminosity for accretion rates above m dot. Okay, below m dot, it's just linearly. The luminosity goes linearly with m dot. But above m dot Eddington, the luminosity goes as the log of m dot over m dot Eddington. Okay? So it grows very slowly. So the luminosity will exceed the Eddington luminosity, but only if you jack up the accretion rate to really, really large values. Okay? And so if we think back to this efficiency we were talking about, the luminosity is not going up very much, but the accretion rate's going up a lot. So these would be low efficiency flows. Okay? And that's important. That's something I'll come back to. Okay, so that's all I was going to say about the Eddington luminosity. So with the next part of the talk, I want to do the observational motivation, which is ultraluminous X-ray sources. Now, as I said, there's other things like tidal disruptions that are motivational as well, but I'd rather explain one topic in detail than give you a broad brush. So I'm going to talk to you about ultraluminous X-ray sources. Okay. So these are basically quite observationally defined. These are any X-ray source that's seen in nearby galaxies that, for some length of time, its luminosity exceeds 10 to the 39 ergs per second. And if you think back to my earlier slide, that's the Eddington limit, Eddington luminosity for a 10 solar mass black hole. And so they didn't think, for various theoretical reasons, that you'd get black holes much larger than 10 solar masses. So they said anything above 10 to the 39 must be super Eddington, or it must be some weird black hole. Now, 10 to the 39, I think you can make 10 solar mass black holes. Probably we now know you can make 30 solar mass black holes. So I tend to really focus on things that are 10 to the 40. Ergs per second, or 10 to the 41 ergs per second, which are definitely observed. So these things would either have to be 100 or 1,000 solar mass black holes if you want a sub-Eddington accretion, or they're exceeding their Eddington limits by factors of at least 10 or 100. Okay, so those are the most interesting sources, and we do see them. And in some cases, they're pretty abundant. If you have galaxies that are forming stars at very high rates, like the Antenna Galaxy, you actually see many of these ULXs. So they're not extremely rare systems, at least not in these star-forming galaxies. And so the big debate has always been, what's driving these things? One idea is super Eddington accretion, obviously, and we'll discuss that. Another idea is that there's beamed emission for some reason. So something about the flows tends to have most of the radiation come out along a particular direction, usually. It's thought to be that spin axis of the black hole or the angular momentum axis of the disk. For some reason, the radiation is beamed into a small, narrow angular region. And so when we estimate the luminosity, we multiply by 4 pi, but that 4 pi is much too big of a number, and the real luminosities are lower. They're sub-Eddington. And there's various ideas of why that might be, but usually you have to make the flow really thick to get beaming, which is sort of would suggest it needs to be super Eddington anyway. But I'll talk a little bit more about that.
You could have jets,
but the jets are usually thought to be predominantly radiating radio emission, and the standard jets that you'd get wouldn't give you a lot of X-rays. So this is almost all coming out in X-rays. So in order to get an X-ray dominated jet, you need to do so.
Maybe these are X-ray dominated jets. So
well, so there's if they seem to be radiating thermal emission. And so if you put in the numbers for what a X-ray dominated jet would look like, it's actually hard to make a model of that that's sensible. But I don't know that anyone has looked at it in detail. I'll talk to you about a scenario in which beaming is important. So we could discuss it. And then the idea is this intermediate mass black hole, or IMBH for short, if I refer to it that way. These could just be normal sub-Eddingtonian accretion disks that are 10 to the 4 solar mass black holes. The problem with that scenario is there seem to be a lot of these things, and it's not easy to make 10 to the 4, 10 to the 1,000 solar mass black holes. As I said, the people who try to do this by normal stellar evolution find it hard to make things even above 30 solar masses. That's why the LIGO detection of 230 solar mass black holes was such a surprise, right? So making something that's 100 or 1,000 probably requires some weird dynamical interactions in the centers of clusters or something like that. And we don't necessarily expect that to be a common process.
Isn't there evidence claim that at the centers of some clusters there is IMBHs?
Well, for the most part, there's not. There's a few cases where there's some evidence. I would say, though, that people have looked really hard. And for the most part, the evidence has not been easy to come by. Would be my way of characterizing. There's a few exceptions with radio emission. I know, Brian, you've paid more attention to this. You think there's good cases for?
They seem to come and go.
Yeah. So I don't think there's any really strong case where you see radio, X-ray, you sort of see everything you'd want to see. Okay. And dynamically, it's very hard to tell. There's no good dynamical estimate that you could say, oh, there's got to be a 10,000 solar mass thing there. Okay, and then there's this question of whether maybe a lot of them will be neutron stars, because at least one case is a neutron star. Okay, now I'm going to start, I'm going to talk mostly about super Eddington accretion models, but I will just quickly go over the one case that I do think is an intermediate mass black hole to tell you what one should look like. What we think it should look like. And it's a source called HLX1 and ESO243-49. People call it, that's the galaxy. It's the hyperluminous X-ray source 1 because it's the brightest one. Most people just refer to this as HLX1. It's really particularly interesting. It's 10 to the 42 ergs per second. So if it was a 10 solar mass black hole, that would be 1,000 times Eddington minimum. Or 10 to the 4. So if it's Eddington, it requires a 10 to the 4 solar mass black hole. It's not an AGN. You can see it's not at the center of the galaxy. Also, it doesn't have the right spectrum. AGN peak in the optical ultraviolet. This thing, all the radiation's coming out in the X-rays. And it has these cycles, these outburst cycles, that are actually very reminiscent of X-ray binaries that I was talking about earlier. So it actually kind of behaves like an X-ray binary, too. So it doesn't really behave like an AGN. And so one thing you might want to do is look at the spectrum of this source and see if it makes any sense. Okay? Does this actually look like the spectrum of an intermediate mass black hole? So this is what the spectrum data looks like near the peak where the luminosity is the highest. This is photon energy in KeV, and this is basically like the luminosity, in some sense, as a function of energy bin. So if you ask, where would you expect this to peak? So it's more massive than an X-ray binary, maybe by a factor of 1,000 or so. And so if you actually think about how the temperature of the inner disk, most of this energy is coming from the inner disk, you think about how that scales. Well, temperature, if it's thermal emission, should go like the flux to the 1/4 power. And so if you want to compute the flux, the flux is the luminosity divided by the area. The luminosity, we think, scales with the Eddington rate, so the luminosity should go up proportional to the mass. The area, we think, is set by the innermost stable circular orbit, so we think that should scale like the mass, the gravitational radius. And so you take the luminosity, which goes as mass, divided by the area, which goes as mass squared, you get the flux goes as 1 over the mass. So the flux actually drops as the mass goes up, and so the temperature drops as the mass goes up. So these more massive things should be cooler, okay, at the same accretion rate. If you scale the accretion rate with the Eddington rate, more massive things should be colder. That's why X-ray binaries peak in the X-rays and quasars peak in the optical ultraviolet. These things, if they're 1,010 solar mass or 10 to the 4 solar mass, should peak in the soft X-rays. X-ray binaries peak at about 2 to 3 kV. This thing peaks at about half a kV. So it looks exactly like what you'd expect. Yeah? You couldn't. I mean, normal stellar evolution couldn't produce something like this. So I'm going to say I think it is a 10 to the 4 solar mass black hole. So one idea is that this is the stripped, since it's off axis, there does seem to be a source. If you look at this, there does seem to be a stellar population near here. And some people have proposed that this is the nucleus of a dwarf galaxy that's been stripped. And there is probably some dynamical process at the center of this dwarf galaxy that produced an intermediate mass black hole. So that's one way you get at it without having to rely on some weird stellar evolution. This is like the seed supermassive black hole in a small galaxy. That's at least one possibility. That might explain why this is actually a very rare source. At 10 to the 42 ergs per second, it's the most luminous, ultra-luminous X-ray source. What's that?
How reliable is the observation?
I think it's pretty reliable. Which part of the observation? So the only question is whether it's in the galaxy. So we see the flux in the X-rays, and so the only question is whether it's in the galaxy or not. It could be a chance coincidence or a background source, but there's actually an emission line at the redshift of the galaxy that corresponds exactly to its position. There's just a bright emission line coming from right there in the galaxy, and it's exactly consistent with the redshift of the galaxy. So it does really seem like this thing is located in the galaxy, and then given the observed X-ray flux, it's 10 to the 42 ergs per second.
What's the range and the output? I mean, it's a 1 year period, so 10 to 42 is the maximum.
Yeah, so it drops down to essentially background at some, it's below the background at some points. So it's at least a factor of 100.
That's a big fluctuation.
Yeah, but that's actually what you see in X-ray binaries. So if this is a companion feeding it, there could be a disk instability, which is what we think drives this variability in X-ray binaries that could be causing the same sort of outburst cycle. There's some trickiness to getting that to work, which, you know, these people model these things with a lot of detail. But it wouldn't be all that different from what we see in X-ray binaries.
Is there any IMK or elements?
So I don't think there's a prominent, you mean at the,
like
yeah, the, well you can see this is about the best spectrum we get. I mean, it's pretty far away, so we don't get a lot of photons, so, yeah. They're all different observations, yes. So this is a combination of XMM, Swift, and Chandra data, and each one of these is a different data set. They all looked at it at the same time. The main thing is that they all get a consistent spectrum. And so anyway, I fit this with my PhD work was developing general relativistic models of accretion disk spectra. And I fit this, and it actually, the best fit is a 10 to the 4 solar mass black hole just below the Eddington limit. So I was happy. I got to use my model. And just to show you, since I didn't show you an X-ray binary spectrum, this is where an X-ray binary peaks. It's 2 to 3 kV. This is, again, fit with my model. And then this is soft X-ray peak of this, this source, HLX1. Okay, so you really do see a difference. This looks different. Okay. So maybe all these things are intermediate mass black holes, except most ultra-luminous X-ray sources don't look like this. In fact, most of them, if anything, they actually peak in the hard X-rays. Okay, and so maybe 10 years ago when I started thinking about these sources, we just had XMM and other and Chandra, and those don't have a lot of sensitivity above 10 keV. So it was a little hard to know what was going on in the hard X-rays here. We just knew there was a lot of hard X-rays. So hard X-rays, usually I mean X-rays above about 2 keV are hard, X-rays below 2 keV are soft. So there's a lot of hard X-ray emission here. And wasn't until NuSTAR came along. NuSTAR actually has a really good sensitivity above 10 keV. It really showed that there's a turnover here. And this turnover really is actually well fit by something like a Veen tail. So this really does look like it's thermal emission. Either it's thermal emission or it's comptonization by thermal electrons with temperatures that put them at about 10 keV, okay, or around 10 keV. So there seem to be really hot electrons around in this system to produce this hard X-ray feature. And this is seen in several different sources. It's more common to see this than to see the soft spectrum that I just showed you for HLX1. And so if you look at this temperature, of course, the way you do that is you keep the mass low. You keep it at 10 solar masses, and you jack up the accretion rate. Okay? But then if you want to get temperatures so that you put it up here, then you have to go to super Eddington accretion. And this whole, you know, we don't know if this temperature, simple temperature scaling works when you have super Eddington accretion, right? Because there we think the flow structure changes. Okay? So we need a better model. If we really want to show whether this is super Eddington accretion, we need a better model for this super Eddington accretion regime. Okay? And so there were models people made, analytic models, but it's a fundamentally 2D problem because the flow gets thick, really a 3D problem. And so this was a strong motivation to do numerical simulations. Okay? All right. So this is what my group and I, we've been trying to do. Okay? And I'll just go over the equations we solve really quickly. The reason there's a lot of work done on accretion numerical simulations with MHD. And so we have MHD in our simulations too. I'm not showing it here. But I do want to point out what we do really well is the radiation transfer. Okay? We solve the radiation transfer equation directly in our simulations. So in every zone of our simulations, we have typically a grid of 80 angles, and we solve the gray, so we frequency average the equations, but we solve the transfer equation along every one of these 80 directions, every time step, in every zone in our simulation. And that's expensive, and it's challenging, but you know, we think that's what you have to do the radiation transfer correctly. Okay? And so you solve this transfer equation. There's a source term here on the right-hand side. Just for those who are relativist inclined, we solve the intensity. We solve for this in an Eulerian frame. We evaluate these source terms in a co-moving frame. So we have to transfer the intensities to the co-moving frame, evaluate the source term, and then transform back to the Eulerian frame. But that's pretty straightforward to do. So it's relativistically covariant. And then we, from integrating these source terms, we can get source terms for the momentum equation and the energy equation and couple it back to the hydro. Okay? And then we, of course, have the gravitational potential of the black hole to deal with. Now, obviously, we'd really like to be doing this in full general relativity, but I have to confess we are not doing general relativistic simulations. We're using a pseudo-Newtonian treatment, so we do have some of the features of a black hole, the Paczynski-Witta potential. But we're not yet doing it in full general relativity. The MHD part of the code is fully general relativistic, but doing the radiation transfer in general relativity is challenging. And I have one slide about our work on that at the end. Okay? But these are the equations we're solving. Okay? Radiation MHD. So first I'll tell you about one simulation we did. This is already a...
Sorry, can you go?
Yeah, go, sure. Oh, yeah, so I stiff source terms. Yeah, so I mean, I wasn't going to, so there's actually, so solving this is really hard. But actually, we have to do, so this is gets into numerical details, but these source terms are really stiff. So we have to be very careful about how we handle these source terms to make the code work well. So there's additional challenges just numerically. This is a really, generally speaking, radiation transfer is much harder to do than pure hydro or pure MHD.
That's what happened. If your matter is Newtonian, but the photons are relativistic, than photons, I mean, the time scale for.
Yeah, so we have to resolve the light crossing time. So you'd think we wouldn't have stiff source terms because nothing can travel faster than light, right? But it's because you're doing averages over grid zones in some sense. If you actually, we can discuss this offline, but it's essentially because of the way the grid zones are averaged. The relaxation times are still a problem. The equations are still stiff.
So I, at bottom equation, I is the photon.
Oh, yeah, it's the specific intensity, yes.
Yeah, and J are what?
Oh, sorry, this is the emissivity, these are opacities, so this is the addition of photons, and this is the removal of photons, and then this includes removal by scattering, and then there's another source term due to the scattering, which here I've assumed is isotropic, so it's proportional to J, which is the angle averaged intensity. I should have explained that more detail, but this is just all the source terms that couple scattering, emission, and absorption. Actually, it's a little more complicated than this in our because we have some poor treatment of Compton scattering as well.
And so you said the upper equations you're treating relativistically, but not the bottom.
Well, so for these equations, for this, so I should be careful. We can treat these relativistically. The code is fully general relativistic. But for these simulations, we're treating them in a Newtonian. Because the transfer is Newtonian, we're treating these as Newtonian. And the only relativistic effect is this pseudo-Newtonian gravitational potential. Thanks. Yeah? Yeah, I left it out to keep the equation simply. But we solve the ideal MHG equation. So it's basically the induction equation in the limit of infinite conductivity. And then the source terms for that. Then there's terms that come back into the momentum and energy equation as well. Sorry, I left it out.
Well, why do you expect the general relativistic effects to be important?
Well, so I'll comment on that a little bit. So other people include them. They do the transfer in a simpler way, and they include relativistic effects, and they disagree with us. And so they say that's because we don't include general relativity. Or most likely because of that. We say it's because they don't do the transfer well. Yeah.
Potential GM over C squared R. Mm-hmm.
Yeah.
So is it?
What do you mean? Should it be important?
Yeah.
Mm. Well, it's almost certainly is important. So it's important for a couple of reasons. One is, so we don't have the spin of the black hole. We don't have, you know, this is some approximation to a non-spinning black hole. But in these simulations of MHD, where you have magnetic fields, they can thread the black hole, and they can get spin up, and they can drive jets. So just the spin of the black hole can drive powerful outflows without any radiation. And we're completely missing that effect in our simulations. So when I talk about our outflow, how much outflow we get, we're losing an important driving source. So I think it is important to eventually include general relativity for that reason alone, but other reasons possibly as well. Is that? All right. How am I doing?
Do you have 20 minutes?
Okay, that's fine. All right, so I want to report on one simulation, the first simulation we did. It really is just one simulation, but it was a good one, I think. We did a black hole mass of 7 solar masses because we were thinking about X-ray binary type masses. This is the peak of the observed mass distribution from X-ray binaries. It's sort of value that people studying the end states of stellar evolution thought would be fairly common for black holes. So we picked 7 solar masses. We set it up so that it had an accretion rate onto the black hole of about 20 times the Eddington rate. We did it in cylindrical coordinates. That's a little weird because that means basically our inner boundary is an inflow boundary. So that means our black hole is a cylinder. So that's a little sketchy, but I think it's okay.
It's the cosmic spin.
What?
It's a black spin.
Yes, exactly. That's what we had in mind. Non-relativistic hydro, I already said, we use a lot of angles. It's the initial condition for all of these things are tori that are centered at some number of gravitational radii. This was 25 Schwarzschild radii, so 50 M. And we have some magnetic fields threading this. And that's because that allows it to be unstable to something called the magnetorotational instability, which provides the magnetic stresses that drive the accretion in the first place. And so we ran this for as long as we could afford to, because you know we want to get equilibrium out to as large a radius as possible. And one simulation took about 230 CPU years. So these are expensive simulations. Maybe not by cosmology standards, but certainly by standards of what other people do. This shows the accretion rate as a function of the Eddington rate versus time. This is in light crossing times for the Schwarzschild radius. So, and you can see it takes a little while for the instability to work, but then we get a lot of accretion, and then we sort of reach something like a steady state where we're getting about 20 solar masses moving inward. That's what the minus sign stands for here. This shows what our initial, the density configuration in our initial torus. So we've cut the simulation in half. There's magnetic fields that thread this initial torus loops that seed the MRI. I'll just play the movie. I'm sorry, I don't have the best exciting movies, but you can see this is what happens. You get accretion into the inner regions. This thickens a little bit because you get material coming out in outflows and things. You can see our cylindrical black hole at the center. But you can see we get a very thin accretion disk forming in this. And that was actually, that's a little surprising because these flows were supposed to be thick. This is super Eddington. The radiation forces are supposed to puff the disk up. But this is a logarithmic scale. You can see the vast majority of the material is in actually a relatively thin accretion disk with, you know, a lot of, it's thick in the sense that there's still a lot of material up here. There is still material up here, but it's a small fraction of the overall material. Yes.
So is it two-dimensional or three-dimensional?
It's a three-dimensional simulation, and so I've taken a 2D slice. I've just, like, cut through it.
Cuts around.
Yeah, yeah. So the whole thing is a donut, and we just cut it in half to make this plot.
So why does it stay thin?
I'll get to that, yeah. That's exactly the interesting question. Okay, so why does it say thin? Actually these are out of order for some reason, I'm sorry. I'll come back to that slide. This is kind of what the flow structure looks like more broadly. So you can see in the inner flow region here, this is not relativistic, but we do get, because there's radiative acceleration of the material, we get velocities are getting up to about a third of c. So this is a radiatively driven jet in this region, a thin disk, and then this sort of corona-like thick structure above the disk. This gives you a rough idea of where the thermalization photosphere is, and this gives you a rough idea where the electron scattering photosphere is. So the funnel here is initially fairly optic. It's actually kind of a little bit optically thick. So photons are diffusing out of that. Now, what's actually happening here? What I told you earlier about advection, the idea is that you have photons that are diffusing upward in the disk versus photons that are getting advected into the black hole. And so the inflow part is shown by this red curve. So this is actually the velocity with which material is moving into the black hole. And then you can think of the photons diffusing outward, you can think of that as having a velocity. Now that velocity is not the speed of light because they're scattering, and so they're constantly changing direction, so the net velocity with which they move is much, much lower than the speed of light. It's basically the speed of light divided by the optical depth, which can be 100 in this case. So it's quite a bit slower. And so that's shown by this black curve. Okay, so this velocity is at most a hundredth of c, because that's the optical depth. And so so normally the idea is that where the velocity, so the advection and diffusion, what people had been comparing before was this inflow versus diffusion. Okay. And where diffusion is shorter, or where the velocity is higher, the photons get out. That's the outer part of the disk. And where the diffusion is shorter, where the velocity associated with diffusion is shorter, they get advected in. Okay, and so you're losing all this energy that's getting advected in. Now, the thing that people didn't account for was the possibility that photons could be advected in the vertical direction as well. And so if we compute the vertical advection of photons, it's actually really high. Okay? We're actually advecting the photons out at a very high rate. And some of this is associated with an outflow, okay, that's actually leaving the disk. But actually, a lot of it is actually associated with circulations that are going on that are driven by magnetic fields, which I'll say more about on the next slide. But what I would like to point out is that when you have transport, if you look at what the radiation force is, it's proportional to the flux, proportional to the radiation flux. But actually, it's only proportional to the co-moving flux. If there's flux associated with advection, which is what we're talking about here, it's most of the flux, you actually subtract that off when you compute the force. It doesn't contribute to the force. And so the radiation is that's being advected out, because you're advecting most of it out, it's not pushing the gas out, and this is why it's staying thin. Okay. So what's happening here? Well, all of these accretion flows that we look at, there's magnetic fields present. There's this dynamo basically operating in the disk associated with this magnetorotational instability. And it's a really complicated topic, so I'm not going to try to explain it all to you. But it's seen in almost all the simulations, certainly in the local simulations where people focus on a small portion of the disk. And what you see here, this shows the toroidal component of the magnetic field, the part that's going, you know, around the disk with the disk. And you can see it's flipping signs here. But you can see this is what this is the average, the horizontal average, is a function of height and time. And what you can see is this structure is actually moving away from the midplane here. You can actually see things moving up with time. And that's basically this toroidal field on average is buoyantly rising away from the midplane. And basically it's rising buoyantly because where you have strong magnetic field, it's in pressure equilibrium. So the gas pressure is lower in regions where the magnetic field is strong. And that causes the density to be lower, so it rises buoyantly. And so some of the field is rising buoyantly, the strong field regions, and then the lower field regions is falling. And so it gives you a circulation pattern where there's no net flow of matter. Okay? But what you're doing is you're taking strong magnetic field regions where the midplane, where the radiation density, energy density is large, moving it to the surface where it can diffuse away, and then you have low energy density material from the surface that's falling down. That gives you a net transport of radiation outward, photon advection.
Yeah. So how do gas pressure, radiation pressure, and magnetic pressure compare?
So in this particular simulation, it's a function of radius. But radiation is like 30 times the gas pressure and magnetic pressure, which are comparable in this particular simulation. Other simulations, which I'll show briefly, it's even higher ratio of radiation to gas pressure. Okay. This was seen in local simulations, but it was never seen in global simulations before this. So we're the first ones to see this in, or at least note it in global simulations. So what this means is that so we end up getting a flux that's rather constant from the inner 20 or 40 gravitational radii. The radiative luminosity that comes out is about 10 times the Eddington luminosity. So the accretion rate going in is 20, and then the actual luminosity that goes out is 10 times the Eddington. It's not this small factor. It's actually a substantial enhancement in the luminosity. The kinetic luminosity outflow is only about 1/5 the radiative luminosity. So most of this radiation gets out without driving that much energy into the outflows. Okay. And this is the opposite of what other people found. Most people found that most of the energy, other people have simulated, found that most of the energy is coming out in the kinetic energy, and only about 1/5 of the energy is coming out in the photons.
Is that true with such high accretion rates? That's certainly true at low accretion rates, but why would that be true at high?
Why are we seeing this? We're seeing it entirely because we have this extra advection process that's getting the energy out. That's what the other people who are doing this, they do not see the same advection process operating. So what we're doing that's different, what we don't exactly understand why we see it in ours and they don't in theirs, but But this, in all the high-resolution simulations, we see this advective flux. And so we don't understand. We think it's good reason for it to be in our simulations, but we don't understand why it seems to be absent in theirs.
But is it the same equations that they're solving? Or is it
so they're solving the same MHD equations, but they're doing fully general relativistic with a simplified treatment of radiation transfer.
So that's the thing that's missing.
So yeah, so if they, what they're doing better than us is general relativity. What they're doing worse than us is radiative transfer. We're also doing the MHD a little bit better, but that's pretty fine details. So they like to say that it's probably general relativity, and we like to say that it's us doing better radiation transfer. This is Ramesh and Sadowski in their group. Friends of mine, so you know, it's a friendly rivalry, I hope. And they might be right. I mean, you know, I'm not saying we definitely have it figured out, but it's interesting that we don't agree. So anyway, we can compute spectra from our simulation, and that's the judge of any good astronomy theory. So we take our model and we just compute a spectrum from the model. I use something called Monte Carlo radiation transfer, and the model I basically get out is this green line, and my friend took this and fit it to this NGC 1313. There's a little bit of soft X-rays that we can't fit well. We need to add another component in there, but it actually goes through the data almost perfectly. And that's kind of amazing, right? I didn't tune the simulation to make this work. It kind of just actually fits. He did give himself the freedom to arbitrarily scale it up and down in the normalization, but there's no other parameters. So it naturally kind of gives this spectral curvature, which is seen in the observations, right from the simulation. Okay.
So do you have lines in there? So do you predict?
We don't have the lines. It's just continuum. It's just Compton scattering and free. So we should do the lines at some point. Lines are hard, right?
Yeah.
Yeah.
Once you get below KPB, it will be
four. I agree. Yeah. Just to comment on the other people, I've been referencing the other people. So the other group on this is Narayan and Sadowski. Again, these are my friends and collaborators. I think very highly of them. And so I'm not saying we're right, they're wrong. It's that simple. I do like our model better. What they do is they simulate this using something called M1 closure scheme for their for the radiation. So they solve the radiation moment equations. They solve conservation of energy, conservation of momentum. And if you stick to that rather than the radiation transfer equation, it's easier to include relativistic, general relativistic correction terms. And so they do that. But this M1 scheme has various problems. It's a simplified approximation, and there's certain tests you can show that it fails pretty badly. So there's always this concern that if you're doing M1, there might be something wrong with the radiation field you're computing. So what they find, so this shows their simulation. This is one of their very high accretion rate simulations. This is the optical depth. So this is the large scale, this is the large scale of the simulation, and this is zoomed in towards the center. You can see they have a very narrow funnel in their simulations that's very optically thick. It's very thick. So again, they don't have this advection term. All the photon, it's diffusing. And so it's more like this picture that people had envisioned than our simulation, where you have a very thick flow.
They could have that advection term, just it's small.
They have a small, it's small in their simulations, OK? And so they find a lower radiative efficiency, about 1% compared to 5% for us. And more of the energy is coming out in a kinetic outflow in their simulations. They have computed spectra. Their spectra look like this. They strongly depend on viewing angle. This is the inclination relative to the line of sight. So I here of 10 means that you're looking nearly down the axis of the black hole. And you can see when you're looking down this axis, okay, you see this is where it's the brightest. And it's also where the spectrum's the hardest, because you see deepest into the potential where the electrons are highest. And they get actually a spectrum that also looks kind of like what was seen in the observation. So as long as they can fit this with this beamed, nearly face-on accretion scenario, they can actually explain these as well. Now, the problem is, and I should note, there's a Japanese group that's been working on this. And they find fairly similar things with non-relativistic treatment of pseudo-Newtonian potential.
So you can avoid the high masses then?
The high masses, sorry?
Is that, so it means you
Yes, exactly. So in neither case, neither our case nor their case, you need a high mass black hole. Thank you. Now, what the problem is, I said there are a lot of these ultraluminous X-ray sources, and so they're thought to be so. And these, you can get accretion rates that are pretty high, but these are short-lived periods in binary evolution. So it's kind of since their radiative efficiency is low, they need a higher accretion rate than we do. So they need to supply these things with much more mass per unit time than we do, and so beaming makes it harder to explain the large number of sources that are observed, because if it's beaming, then there's a lot of other sources that we're not seeing that also need to be explained. Whereas if they're not beamed, then we only have to explain the absorbed sources that are observed, and the numbers that are observed are kind of consistent with the people who model binary evolution, what they think can be achieved. The other problem is there's actually direct observations, calorimetric observations of these sources. So these sources are surrounded by big gas clouds in some cases, gaseous nebulae, and you have a bright X-ray source in the center. It's shining on the gas, and it's ionizing all the photons. Okay, and then these photons that are being ionized or either via recombination radiation or maybe in some cases some excitation process, then de-excite radiatively. So if you look at them in the optical UV, you see emission lines. And you can measure the amount of radiation coming out in the emission lines, and you say, how much luminosity does that source at the center of this gaseous nebula have to have? And in all the cases where people have done this, it's consistent with the isotropic luminosity. So it would seem to suggest these sources aren't beamed. Okay, so if you want to explain these sources as beamed emission, you have to grapple with the fact that there's a lot more sources than we realize, than we actually see, and you have to explain why these calculations are wrong. So we're still very excited about our idea that the radiative efficiency is high. Now, the main problem is that we have this criticism that our simulations kind of sucked. I mean, we're doing this cylindrical black hole. There's not general relativity. So we're trying to work on that. So the first thing we did is we're now running this in Athena++, which is a much better code. It's got AMR. It's got fully general relativistic MHD, although we're still doing Newtonian because the transfer is not yet fully general relativistic. But we can do much larger simulation domains. We're running this on spherical polar grids. And we have a ton of time. We get about 50 million CPU hours a year from the Department of Energy for the last couple of years. So we can do these big simulations. And you know, this is just showing the density. Well, you can see, you know, now we're doing these, you know, this is a very large aspect ratio now. That said, it takes time for this to reach equilibrium, and so we can really only reach inflow equilibrium out to about 20 or 30 gravitational radii, and which is kind of a problem for us because there's still stuff going out here at 100 gravitational radii that's contributing to the simulations in some ways. So these are challenging simulations to assess. I'm probably out of time, right?
Almost. Yep.
Okay. I'll just say that there's a paper that came out on the archive this morning where we now look at super Eddington accretion onto 10 to the 8 solar mass black holes. So we're thinking about tidal disruptions. For the most part, I'll just say that the results are consistent with our earlier work. Even though we're moved to spherical polar grids, there's the main conclusions are similar. We still get high radiative efficiencies. We do it in very different ways. This is something you and I should talk about offline. We see that when the radiation gas pressure is really high, we actually damp the turbulence that's normally thought to drive the accretion. And it's actually like silk damping in the early universe is what's going on. And because of that, now the angular momentum transport is dominated by spiral waves that develop in the simulations. It's not the magnetorotational instability. So the process is actually kind of different, but nevertheless, we still have this vertical advective transport, so the radiation efficiency remains high. And then I'll skip that slide, but I'll just say we are working on doing the fully general relativistic transfer. There's nothing conceptually difficult about it. We derived, I mean, we re-derived, cosmologists did this in the 60s, of course, But we'd re-derive the full transfer equation with all of the frequency and angular terms in it. Of course, it's a six-dimensional phase space. We're already essentially dealing with that anyway. And you can write this down in whatever favorite basis you're working with. We've tried a bunch of different bases to try to simplify it. There's just implementation issues with getting this to work. But we're kind of nailing those down. And so I think in the next year, we'll be doing fully general relativistic simulations. Okay. And then I'll just put up my summary. The main point is that we think you can exceed the luminosity, the Eddington luminosity, and we think we can do it with high radiative efficiencies. Other people disagree with us, though, so we still have to, as a field, and it's really two research groups, maybe three right now, figure out a consensus view. But stop there. Thanks.
Two notes that we're gonna have dinner with Shane tonight at 6 in the bistro, and Shane will be giving a talk on a different topic tomorrow at the University of Waterloo on galaxy formation, I guess.
And feedback outflows.
Yes, so a very different topic, so you're welcome to come there as well. Okay, so questions.
So in these general relativistic simulations, the black holes are all static, right?
Yes. Oh, well, no, so our, in the other group, there are spinning black holes, And so that's actually, so they get a higher kinetic luminosity out from us, and that's probably part of it, because there's black holes are spinning, so they get driving in the luminosity, in the kinetic luminosity from the stresses in the magnetic field that are wound up, so.
Rotating black holes seem to be fairly calm, as I understand.
Yes, so yes. Well, depends on who you ask. There's these crazy people who do these spin estimates. That includes me, who do, so we do tend to get high spins, I agree.
But I'm just saying, ultimately, like I just noticed the last equation, it's a static black hole. Right?
Yes. Oh, so we've.
Ultimately, you want it to be rotating.
Oh, yeah. So I've written it down for Boyer-Lindquist coordinates as well. So Boyer-Lindquist coordinates, as you would imagine, is. I chose Schwarzschild because it's the shortest.
Yeah.
You do Boyer-Lindquist, it expands, but it's still manageable. Kirschschild is a pain in the ass. That's the problem. Boyer-Lindquist is okay. Kirschschild is the problem. You want to do it with Kirschschild.
To get to the bottom of this discrepancy between the different equation models, for the short term, have you thought of just running your Newtonian simulations, but instead of using this more sophisticated?
Sorry. I didn't hear the last part. What?
Sophisticated radiation transfer, just using an M1 closure for that.
Yeah, so we could do that. I mean, we should do that. I've advocated doing that within my research group. And you know, there's fine. I'm a junior faculty, so I don't get any time to actually to implement code myself, so I have to find someone. Yanfei wants to get a job, so he wants to like publish results rather than code up new algorithms. But as soon as I have a student or somebody competent to do it, or the free time myself on sabbatical next spring, I do plan to put an M1 into our code for this reason, partly for this reason, so we can do it, narrow that down. I agree. We have done comparisons with M1 and Newtonian limits with another code where we implemented M1, and we do see big differences on test problems. So there are issues with M1 that we want to understand.
Yeah. I think you could also highlight your postdoc.
Yeah, well, get funding in the U.S. for a postdoc. Good luck.
Okay. Good. Yes.
So you're using the Paczynski-Bitter potential.
Yep.
So that gets the ISCO frequency wrong.
The ISCO frequency wrong. I mean, it gets the position right. I mean, what do you mean by the frequency?
The orbital frequency of the radius.
Actually, I thought it was right. Isn't it?
I don't remember, but
you've worked at this.
Something's going to be wrong.
Yeah, I mean, there's certainly something wrong. I'm not sure if it's the frequency. I mean, obviously, it's not a perfect approximation.
But do you know where that approximation would actually show up in your results?
Well, I think it's hard to say exactly what's going to go wrong because of that. I mean, the nice thing is the ISCO is at the right place, so you know that's what sets where this transition from inflow, wait, did I go to, here, right, you can see, you know, this, the reason this rises rapidly, this is 9, 8, 7, well, actually, no, this is in Schwarzschild, so this is, but this is like 12 gravitational radii, so this really starts to ramp up right outside the ISCO, okay? And so that's what sets where that, that's where it primarily comes in, and so we think it does what it's supposed to there. I think I'm more worried about this issue with the spin. If there's, even for a short, even if it's non-spinning, even if it's spinning a little bit, I think that, that you should get pretty strong Blanchard-Zinajec-like effects. And that probably affects the inner flow structure more than the difference between the Schwarzschild and pseudo-Newtonian. I think it's really this idea that we're not getting spinning black hole effects that worries me the most.
Yeah, 243-49. The only black holes we see are X-ray binary. So it's hard that we don't only see one intermediate black hole.
Yeah.
In the whole sky.
I agree, yeah. I mean, there are a few other cases where people have suggested. So on the higher end, you see things that are 10 to the 5. People infer the existence of 10 to the 5 solar mass ones, which are more usually in the centers of galaxies. So they're more like low end of the AGN distribution. For the ULXs, I mean, some of these ULXs might be 10 to the 4 solar mass black holes, but I don't think there's any that are as good of candidates as that one. They seem to be rare in either they're rare in that they don't exist very much in the local universe, or they just are. It's rare that they have a companion that can accrete onto them and produce a signal. They do seem to be one of those two things. Seems to be not happening. And you could imagine maybe there, for whatever reason, seed black holes are just much more common in the early universe, and there's some other reason why they're less common in nearby galaxies. But I suspect the more likely thing is they're there, we just can't see them because they're not accreting, there's no companion that's accreting from them. There might be some rare condition that set up this situation where this companion could mass transfer onto this.
Five solar mass black hole is hidden in molecular clouds.
I saw that, yeah.
It's conveniently hidden.
Yes, yes. I you know, that was a lot about you know, interpreting line widths from, I think it was ALMA or something. I remember it was some radio, and I don't have a good view ability to assess whether that was realistic, but it seemed like a reach to me. And for exactly the reason you're alluding to.
And it wasn't Nature, I think.
It was in Nature, which also means it's probably wrong, so yeah.
Okay, so if there's no other questions, then let's action again.
Right. Thank you.